Today's Teisho will be on case 23 in the Book of Serenity. Lu Zhu faces the wall. Lu Zhu faces the wall. Bodhidharma's introduction. Bodhidharma's 9 years is called wall gazing. Shengguang's 3 bows divulge the natural potential. How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. Nansen, hearing of this, said, "I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty aeon, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Lu Zhu, that way, will go on till the year of the ass." Verse. In plainness, there's flavor, subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign, unbending like an idiot. His path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar. So this is the first day of our January 2007 session. And I must say that I think we're off to a wonderful start. And because everybody was sitting so beautifully this morning, I wanted to work with this koan today. Lu Zhu faces the wall. This is about a monk named Lu Zhu. And whenever Lu Zhu saw somebody else coming, he would immediately face the wall. This seems like a very strange practice. If you went up to Lu Zhu's temple and he saw you coming, instead of coming out to greet you, instead of coming out to say, hello, I'm so glad you're here, come in, have some tea, he would immediately run inside the Zen hall and sit down and face the wall. And it didn't matter who came. Could be a new monk, new trainee. Could be an official from the government. No matter what, you know, once he saw you coming, he'd just sit down and face the wall. And that was his way of practicing. And so somebody told Master Nansen, the great Master Nansen, about this monk Lu Zhu. And they wanted to know what Nansen thought of this way of practicing, which is very strange. And Nansen said, well, to simplify what Nansen said, he said, listen, Lu Zhu can go on that way until the year of the ass, you know, and nothing's going to change. So it sounds like a put down. There's something apparently wrong with Master Lu Zhu's practice. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Because we could say, well, isn't Zen about being in the moment? Isn't Zen about dealing with what arises? I would get in a lot of trouble in my job if I did what Lu Zhu did. You know what I mean? So, you know, when the semester comes to a close, students come in to complain about their grades. This is like just as, you know, after winter comes spring, after spring comes summer, after summer comes fall, after the end of classes, students come in to complain about their grades, and their parents call me up, and so on. You know, and so they, you know, some my secretary Judy might come to the door and say, "Kurt, there's a student out here to see you," and I go, "Okay, Judy, 1 minute," you know, so I get out the zafu, face the wall, say, "Send him in." He says, "I'm come to complain about my grade. I don't think my grade is fair." So on. Maybe the dean wants to talk to me. Judy could come to the door and say, "You know, the dean's outside. Send her in." No. "Kurt, I want to talk to you about the budget." Okay, so probably I wouldn't continue to keep my job, you know. I probably it could get me in a lot of trouble, right? And that would be true no matter what your line of work. If you invite people over to your house and you see them coming and you sit down and you face the wall, and come over and say, "Well, thanks for inviting us. What's for dinner?" "Where is he?" He's facing the wall. Very strange. So the idea is that this is a very un-Zen-like behavior. And, you know, that he, apparently, person of Zen should be always dealing with the moment. So when the dean comes, I should say, "Hello, hello." And when the student comes to complain, I should be on top of it. And you could say that this is a case of a Zen gone wrong, right? This is like a world-evading Zen practice. But actually, it's very, that's the tricky part of this koan, the tricky part, right? This koan, like all koans, has a hook, or there's something about it that isn't quite right. See? And many people think that koans are like fables or moral stories, and they don't understand that you can't appropriate or you can't enter into a koan in that spirit. You have to be in deep samadhi, and you have to work with the koan for a long time. And that you begin to realize that there's some kind of a contradiction here. It opens up some kind of a contradiction in yourself. Because it would be easy to say this guy, Lu Zhu, is just a bum. You know, he's just a phony. You know, Zen is not about running away. But then, you know, remember this guy named Bodhidharma? You know? Bodhidharma came to China from India, and he was apparently a very highly regarded meditation master, great guru. And he came from India and met Emperor Wu of Liang. And he had an interview with the emperor, and a famous interview. And for those of you who go on unsuccessful job interviews, always remember this story, you know. Because he met the emperor, and the emperor was very interested in meeting this person who was reputed to be great meditation master. And he said, so the emperor said to Bodhidharma, "You know, I myself am quite interested in Buddhism. And I'm a Buddhist, and I have built many temples and many monasteries and nunneries and many pagoda and stupas, and I'd like to know how much merit have I acquired." And Bodhidharma said, "You haven't acquired anything. You haven't acquired anything." And the emperor was a very good man, but he didn't understand this, and he was shocked. And he said, basically, who are you? And Bodhidharma said, I don't know. Or he actually just said, not knowing, not knowing. And that was sort of like the end of the interview. If you go in for an interview, and you come in and they ask you who you are, and you say, I don't know, probably that will terminate the interview. So Bodhidharma left the palace, and he went up into the area around a Shaolin, like a sacred forest area. It's called the Shaolin or Paolin. And it's where the martial arts monastery is now. Near there, he sat in a cave for 9 years, practicing what's called Piquan, facing the wall. Now, you know, if you're interested in making social change, if you're interested in bringing about, in making a difference, as they say, in your life, this is a strange way to do it, right? Bodhidharma came all the way from India, and it was not an easy journey in those days. He was in his 50s, so he was about the same age as I am, maybe mid-50s. And he went to this strange country, a different language, totally different customs, to bring Zen. And he meets with the emperor, and it doesn't work out, and he goes and he sits in a cave for 9 years and just waits for something to happen. And you could say, my God, man, get off your ass and get out there, you know, and tell people about Zen, you know. And Zen you could package it, you know. You could get out there and explain to people and go out on the street and say, listen, have you heard about Zen? You know, you're a busy man, you're a busy woman, you need to relax, you know. Let me tell you about Zen. And you could write a book, you know, on Zen, and you could get on the talk shows and talk about Zen. And people would lots of people would practice Zen. That makes sense, right? But strangely, Bodhidharma didn't do that. He sat in front of a wall for 9 years and just waited for something to happen. Right? This is like the opposite of rational behavior in a certain way. Right? And so, it makes it hard to understand nonsense put down of Luzhu. Nonsense says, oh brother, you know, that guy, he could sit till, we would say, he can sit till the cows come home and nothing's going to happen. Well, Bodhidharma could sit, you know, till the cows came home and nothing was going to happen. He just sat there for 9 years waiting for somebody to show up. And after 9 years, amazingly, you're in the middle of China. There's no Shaolin temple yet. It's just a wilderness. You're sitting there every day meditating, and somebody shows up, see? And in fact, not one person, but three people. Two men and a woman were Bodhidharma's Dharma heirs. And those three people are responsible for starting Zen in China, those three students of Bodhidharma. So that you begin to see that there's a kind of a strange contradiction here, right? I mean, we're all engaged in worldly life. We all have life paths that involve us in the world of time, of energy, of effort, you know, concern, all of these things. Some of you are scientists. Or studying to be scientists. Some of you are interested in the arts. Some of you are writers, you know. Some of you are scholars. Some of you are on your way to like medical careers, journalists. You know, this is all very impressive. Somebody could say, well, so what are you doing here? And there's a part of your mind which might indeed say, what am I doing here? You know? Because in a certain way, this looks like maybe running away. It's possible for somebody to say we're just running away when we do this. You know? And it's possible to practice in that spirit. I have to tell you that a lot of the time, the reason I think I stuck with practice early in my life was because I was running away, you know. I was so fearful that I just threw myself into my practice because I wasn't very happy. I mean, some of you are very good at what you do, and you're really lucky. Because when I was in graduate school, I was trying hard, but I wasn't particularly good at what I was doing. And that was a very frustrating experience. So I threw myself into my practice. You know? And that was the best thing I ever did. But I never, except for the fear, I didn't know why I was doing this. You know, and probably you don't know exactly why you're doing this either. I mean, it's really not always possible to give a reason for the things we do. In fact, usually our reasons are very false, you know. And so, last night I was talking about how when I first started practicing Zen, my first sesshin was kind of just a surprise. I had been practicing only for a little while, like a couple months. I was going to the University of Washington campus. And I was sitting with Genki Roshi and Webb Sensei's meditation group. And I could barely get through 25 minutes. It would be like, by the end of that period, I would be straining to get through. You know? And this beautiful woman named Wendy Nicow asked me if I was going to sesshin. And so I said, yes, definitely. And then I said, what is sesshin anyway? So I went to sesshin, and it was like being run over by a car, you know. But something brought me back. Something brought me back. And it was the strangest thing. Sesshin was the weirdest thing I had ever done. And it was unlike anything else in its effects on me. You know, unlike anything else ever that I've... it's still true. It's still unlike anything else I ever do, you know. It's a little bit like backpacking up in the mountains. You know, it's a little bit like that. But it's more like backpacking in the Amazon jungle and you have no map, you know. And you don't know if you'll ever get through the jungle. You know, it's a little bit closer to that, I think. So it was a shocker. And yet, for some reason, I came back. I actually signed up for another one. Right? And of course, the second one is always harder than the first because you know what's coming. Right? And as I mentioned last night, when people would say, you know, sesshin is a month away, it would be like the butterflies. And I said, ooh, sesshin. And I would, play a little game with myself, you know, we used to have sesshin in a place called the Hood Canal. There was a summer camp that a group of liberal Baptists loaned us. They allowed us to use it. They let us use this facility. It was very beautiful. It was right on the water. The Hood Canal is really not a canal. It's a channel. It's misnamed, but it's a beautiful body of water in the Olympic Mountain area. And we used to have to take a ferry to get there. And then it would be just a beautiful place to do sesshin. And, we'd go there and sit for these days. And I just didn't know why I was doing it, you know? I would play these mental games with myself. I would be on the ferry thinking, "Why am I doing this? You know, this is crazy. You know, I graduated. I should be reading Heidegger right now. I should be," and also, it was difficult to leave when we had Zazen in the winter, because we had Zazen, our Sangha had Zazen the day after Christmas, you know. So basically, the 26th, we all left, and we would have a winter Zazen, and we would always end on New Year's Day. No, New Year's Eve. That was it. So we had, I think it was a 5-day Zazen. And basically, we had to do it like that because school started, we were on a quarter system at the UW. So school started shortly after the new year. It was like the 7th or something, or the 4th or something. So this was the only real time we could have to do Zazen, as I recall. So we would, you know, you'd have to leave all the festivities, right, and the relaxing time to kick back and go to Zazen. And I'd be sitting on the ferry thinking, why am I doing this? You know, yesterday I was, you know, drinking eggnog, you know, and now I'm going to be sitting for 8 or 9 hours a day in darkness, you know. And I would just think, why am I doing this? This is the craziest thing. And yet, for some reason, I kept going. For some reason, I kept coming back and coming back. And if you asked me what was my reason, I guess I could have said, well, it makes me feel better. But I just don't think that's really what we're doing, you know. Or I don't think, another way to put it is, I don't think you can really explain so easily what we're doing. Yeah. Because reasons are not that real. You know, reasons are not that real. And if we live in a world of reasons, that's okay, but it's a very shallow life. It's really a shallow life. Zen is about getting in contact with this deeper mind. Deeper mind. And it's a different way of life altogether. You know, it's really not even like a human way of life in a certain way. It's really not. I mean, I think to be a human is to be caught up in the world of culture. And I don't mean like culture like the arts. I mean culture like television, job, status, politics, you know, all of this stuff. This is like culture. This is like the human world. So you know, you see it every day. I don't know if you read Salon.com, but the Salon.com, everything in our civilization is destroyed by some calamity, and Salon.com somehow downloads and survives, people will see everything about human nature in Salon.com. Because really, it's just like gossip. It's gossip. Politics and gossip, right? And so it's like, you know, what is President Bush going to say on Tuesday when he gives his big speech? And they get all of these experts to predict. They have no idea. But they all predict. And they all make their predictions, you know. And, well, it could go this way, and it could go that way. And what will be the consequences? And then they get another expert to come in. Well, it could be good and it could be bad. You know? And then, you know, they're talking about the new movie, and somebody gives his opinion. This is all the human way, right? Evaluating, putting words on things, assessing in terms of good or bad, right and wrong, trying to sway others, you know, trying to get others to see it your way. And this is like the human realm. And it's all tied in with a deep desire, deep fundamental human insecurities, right? You know, we want so much to be loved by other people, which is a perfectly good motivation, right? And so as a result of that, you know, we're constantly trying to remake ourselves to be lovable, to be, you know, so when we're growing up, we want to be, our parents love us honestly, you know, wholeheartedly, probably. And they want the best for us. And so, you know, we love them and we want to be pleasing to them. And this is, there's nothing wrong with this in a certain way, but it's a little bit artificial, you know, because you start out trying to be what your parents want you to be, and then you meet other people you admire, you want to please them. And you meet all kinds of people that you admire, but sometimes for the wrong reasons, you know. When I was 12 years old, there was a guy named Greg Miller on the base where I lived. And he had a black leather jacket like a biker. And he used to smoke cigarettes, right? And this was, of course, he didn't smoke cigarettes around his parents. He always had hidden cigarettes. And then when he was by himself, you know, with the other kids, other teenagers, he'd start smoking these cigarettes. And he was so cool. And so I too wanted to smoke cigarettes, you know. And I started smoking cigarettes until I got caught, and my father took them away from me and punished me for smoking cigarettes. But the thing that was so horrible about having my cigarettes taken away wasn't the punishment, which was kind of minor. It was the humiliation of not being able to go out and smoke with my friends, you know. So it was so embarrassing, right? So this is like deeply human. You know, even when you're 50 years old, you know, you want to be liked. You want to be loved. You don't want people to go, oh, he's a weirdo, or he's a strange bird. You know, nobody wants to be a strange bird, you know. We want to be acceptable. But the odd thing is, you know, you can't ever be acceptable to everybody, no matter what. You know, President Bush is the president right now. You know, and he's unacceptable to about half the country. And if John Kerry had won, he would be unacceptable to about half the country. That's interesting, isn't it? And there's nobody you could imagine in political office who's going to be acceptable to everybody. There's just no such person. And in fact, there's nobody who's acceptable to everybody, no matter what you do, right? But it gets us very tangled up as we live our lives, trying to please others. After a while, we just don't know who we really are, right? And this is why in our culture, if you go to the bookstores, there's usually this massive library of books on like what is called self-help, right? Self-help. And it's all about how to find happiness, right, really, and how to be, I'm okay, you're okay, and so on. This sort of thing. I'm not putting it down because it's a natural response to confusion, you know, as you try to be pleasing to this person and that person and this person and that person. You're trying to be loved, you're trying to be real, but really, at some point you think, who am I? What am I? And, you know, Zen actually is a response to that same question. You know, who am I? What is my life? You know, what am I doing in my life? You know. And the Zen approach, though, is a little different because instead of looking to others for approval, we're going in a very strange direction, right? We're practicing Piquan. We're doing what Bodhidharma did or what Luzhu did. We're sitting and facing the wall, right? And the wall is like a zero culture, 0 degree culture, right? There's no culture there. There's nobody telling us you should do this or you should be that or you should think this or you should. There's nobody trying to persuade us. There's no scripture, right? There's no in the beginning, thou shalt not. There's no art. The wall is like 0 culture, right? And it's like. We say original face, right? It's your face before your parents were born, right? This is like, what is there before there's anything else? Before there's something, what was there? And there was the wall, Pequan, the wall. And this is what we Zen people do, right? And we're going to do it here for 7 days, seven incredible days, you know. Because the strange thing is, you know, after a while, you aren't just uncertain about who you are, but you're uncertain about what everything is, right? You know, what is real? What is real? You're here at a Zen retreat, a sesshin, so you probably don't think TV is real, right? But the world of TV is real for millions of people. It's the most comforting, reassuring thing in their lives, and they watch it all the time. And there are people who, for whom literature is real. You know, many of my friends in the English department really believe that the most real thing in the world is the world of great writers. You know, and this is what they believe, and they write beautiful books that I'm really not capable of writing. Really beautiful, wonderful studies of these great writers, because for them, this is the bottom line. You know, hang on to this. You know? And for scientists, you know, it's something else, but. For us, Zen people, we don't really have something we can point to and say this is what's really real, because we're going to a place that has that exists before there's a word, before there's a book, before there's a world even. This is the wall. This is where we live our lives, and to practice Zen is to constantly go back to this blankness. This emptiness, we say emptiness or blankness. But even those are just words, right? But this is how we live our lives. And the remarkable thing about this is that it when you go there, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't, you know, rationally, logically, it doesn't make any sense. But if you go there, you begin to feel, in my experience, in my opinion, you begin to feel more alive. For me, anyway. When I go to that place and I stay there, at first it's not necessarily very comfortable. But after a while, I begin to feel so alive, and not for any reason. And if you think about it, there's no reason to be alive. You know, life is bigger than reasons. Reasons are what we attach to life, but life is bigger than our reasons. If you say, why existence? Why does something exist anyway? There's no way to answer that question. Actually, the universe doesn't have a purpose. It doesn't. It doesn't have any purpose at all. Those are human values, their purpose. It doesn't have any meaning, actually. The universe doesn't have a meaning. You know, if I'm trying to fix the garage, you know, I have to confess that I've got to work on my garage, because I have let the doors rot away, their panels at the bottom of my garage doors, and I've got to take them off and replace them with new panels, right? So I'm going, at some point this spring, I'm going to call the company that makes the panels and order them. And they're going to bring the panels, and I'm going to take out the old panels, which are held in with carriage bolts. And I'm going to paint the panels and put waterproofing on them so this doesn't happen again, and attach them to the doors. Now, I've done this, I did this 10 years ago. I can do it again. And that's purpose, right? But the universe doesn't have a purpose in the same way. It doesn't have any purpose. It doesn't, in my opinion. And it doesn't have a meaning. So, basically, you know, you could read a story by a great writer like Joseph Conrad. Maybe you've read Lord Jim. It's an exciting story about a young man who goes to a faraway land and has sort of like a tragic experiences and tries to redeem himself, and he actually dies at the end. Very, very sort of sad tale set in as I recall, Indonesia. It's really a wonderful tale. And you can interpret it in many different ways. In fact, if you go to the library, there's literally like dozens of books on Conrad, Joseph Conrad. And they all say, here's the meaning of Lord Jim. But you know what? The universe, in my opinion, doesn't have a meaning. That's a human fiction. That's a human fiction. We have purposes, and we have, and the things we do have meanings, but the universe is bigger than that. So it's hard to explain what we're doing, but when we sit in emptiness, so-called, for a number of hours every day, you go through a lot of different changes. You may feel at some point depressed. You may feel at some point at a loss. You get tired when you meditate this many hours a day. But probably what's going to happen to you at some point during this session is that you're going to begin to feel really alive. And I just think that's amazing. I mean, that's amazing because we're constantly trying to come alive. We're constantly trying to have richer lives. Get magazines. I myself read magazines. I read Salon.com just for the gossip, because that's all there is, And I read books. I don't really read fiction much anymore, but I read a lot of books. I don't really go to the movies that much, but I like music. All these things are supposed to make our lives richer, and they do to some degree. You might get a new CD. Somebody was kind enough to send me some CDs because of something I said in a Taisha. I said in a Taisha that I had heard some music by Vaughan Williams, and somebody actually sent me 3 tapes by Vaughan Williams. I have to be careful what I say. Right? This person was so kind and sent me these 3 beautiful tapes. They're not really tapes, they're discs. I'm sort of behind the times. She sent me these beautiful CDs. I've been playing them over and over again. They're just so beautiful. But you know what? In my opinion, what I experience when I enter Pequan, when I enter Mu, what I experience is greater than that music. It's greater than that. In fact, the sound of the rain this morning was greater than, even though I love those Vaughan Williams recordings, the sound of the rain this morning was somehow, I felt more alive listening to the rain last night and this morning than I did listening to Vaughan Williams. I don't know why, but I just feel so alive when I am at this, facing this blank wall. It's like being possessed by nature itself. It's like being at the heart of the universe somehow. And I don't know how to describe it. It really can't be described, but the other day, I should explain that where I live in Plainfield, there's actually a lot of trees, a lot of old trees. And there's a lot of bird life, including hawks. There's quite a few hawks. Hawks have really made a comeback in New Jersey. And in fact, if you drive down the Garden State, you can sometimes see a hawk every couple of miles waiting for roadkill. In my neighborhood, there's a Cooper's hawk, and he's huge. He looks like he's 2 feet tall. I'm sure he's not, but he's huge. And he comes, we have a couple of very big pine trees behind our house, and a huge northern magnolia tree. It's 150 feet, and it might be 300 years old. And my wife and I can't put our arms around the trunk of the tree. It's so big. Together, if we put our arms around it, we can't touch hands. And in fact, there's quite a big gap. It's something like 15 feet in circumference. I think it's even more than that. This hawk comes by, And he sits up there, and we have all these bird feeders and bird baths and everything, and he sometimes eats pigeons, and we have an abundance of pigeons. And by the way, I love pigeons, you know. We feed the pigeons, and they're beautiful. People have contempt for pigeons, you know. But they're beautiful. My wife has one in particular that will almost eat out of her hand. It's such a sweet bird. It's really, and they're adorable, and they have soft eyes, and they look at you, and they coo, and they're beautiful. But anyway, I went for like a walk. I went for a long walk, and I came, every once in a while, the hawk will get a pigeon, right? How do we know? Because there's pigeon feathers all over the yard. And I came home, and I was walking up the driveway, and the driveway was covered with pigeon feathers. And I wasn't upset. In fact, you know, I love pigeons, but I love the hawk, right? You know, I mean, I know you have to have both. That's a fact. I thought, gee, that looks like quite a looks like quite a fight going on here. So as I was walking up to take a look, all of a sudden, the hawk must have been sitting on the ground, and eating the pigeon out of sight around the corner of the house. You know, I couldn't see. So I'm walking down the driveway, the house is to the left, there's all these pigeon feathers. And as I go around the corner, the hawk takes off with the carcass in its talons. You know. And it was just thrilling. It was just, I mean, it was thrilling. I just felt the way I sometimes do when I'm sitting on the cushion. It was like I'm in touch with the universe, you know. Barbara later said, I hope he didn't get my favorite pigeon, you know. And I hope he didn't. But, you know, it's a bigger perspective. You know, it's a bigger, you know, we know intellectually that the pigeon isn't the good guy and the hawk isn't the bad guy. You know, we know that. If you love pigeons, right, you know, hawks are a menacing presence. If you love hawks, pigeons are a necessary expenditure, you know. So, but they're both part of life. Right? It's like the bigger whole, bigger picture. And somehow, when I saw that bird, every cell in my body was activated, and I just felt so alive. It's not the human way, you know, really, to some degree. We humans build a world out of right and wrong, yes and no, good and bad. And when we confront something like this, you know, it could be horrible, right? Poor little pigeon, you know, this morning we recited a sutra for Angelique's father, I lost my father, died a number of years ago from cancer, and then my brother also died of cancer, and I know how difficult, I mean, that's about as painful and difficult as it can get, right, in my opinion, even probably worse than getting it yourself, is seeing people you love die in this very difficult way. And yet, you know, even under those circumstances, you know, if you enter mushin, if you go into this blankness, you get in touch with like a bigger picture. It's like the universe, this universe is unfolding in all directions. And it apparently has never stopped. You know, I was reading in Scientific American the other day that you know, they used to think there was the Big Bang, right? They said, you know, once upon a time there was nothing, and then there was a Big Bang, and then everything we know came out of it, and the universe is going to either slow down and stop, and that'll be the end of everything. Or it'll just keep expanding forever, something like that. Or it might implode again. But now, you know, they've done all this research and they've discovered that the universe, as we imagined it, is not the whole picture. That between all these constellations, there are all these black holes. Right? The universe is full of black holes. And there's not just a few of them, they're everywhere. And this dark matter, if I'm getting this right, is most of the universe. So the part of the universe that's knowable and seeable and that has the characteristics of existence as we know it, you know, is actually the minority. It's just a tiny fraction of the whole system. And most of it exists on in a way we can't fully understand because the laws of nature as we know them don't apply. And anyway, this physicist was making the argument that probably what happens is that universes come out of these black holes. Right? These are like so it's not like there was a big bang and then it's going to be over. It's like there's a big bang, and then there's a big bang, and there's not just one in a row. It's not just big bang. This is going on all over, all the time. Universes are coming into existence and going away. It's all over, right? This is the picture many physicists now accept, you know. And, you know, you realize, my God, you know, the universe is so big, it's so vast. And at least part of us wants to say, I wish I could participate more fully in that vastness, you know. At least, because, you know, when you turn on TV and they say, well, Jim, you know, has the president changed his haircut today? You know, I think so. You know, what does it mean? You know, that's a very petty lie, don't you think? Or, in my opinion, it's kind of a petty lie to be too worried about, you know, whether people like the fact that I wear a lot of brown pants. You know, it's actually not that important. You know, or, you know, things like that. You know, or even. You know, maybe I haven't been necessarily the best brother to my sister or brother to my late brother. You know, maybe I could have been a different kind of person, you know, with them. But I always try to show them love, and I still, you know, my sister's still alive. We have a good relationship, but you know. You know, I'm not going to worry too much about what she thinks of me. I'm going to show her love, but, you know, it's a big life. You know, it's a big life, in my opinion. You know, the human way is a small, in my opinion, is a good way. It's a good way, but it's a small way. We have to be human because we are, you know. We're going to leave here. We're going to go back to our jobs. And somebody's going to come in and say, I didn't like the way you wrote this, or I'm going to go back to my job, and somebody's going to say, there's some students out here to complain about their grades, right? And I'm going to welcome them in and say, come on in, how can I help you? Try to be polite and helpful and make them feel better about the way things turned out. But when we come to Zen, you know, this is our chance to participate in a bigger life. It's like not human life, it's bigger than that. And at first, this just sounds like baloney. It sounds like salesmanship, you know. But if you keep going, if you keep doing this, you get it. You begin to get that connection, that sense of connection, that sense of energy, of being connected. And it's not rational. It doesn't give you an insight. You know, there's answers to koans in a certain way. But what really matters is taking down the boundary between yourself and the world, and becoming one with the universe, really and truly. That's what staring at the wall is all about. And so, you know, if you do this long enough, it becomes so obvious that that's what's happening. That sense of deep connectedness, deep energy, deep life. It just grows and grows, and it's absolutely wonderful. And so, you know, 30 years ago, I was going on a trip to the Hood Canal, and I was basically taking the ferry, and thinking, why am I doing this with my little human mind? But you know, at some point, you know, I just began to realize what this is all about. It's so much bigger than that. And Zen practice is about living more of your life in that bigger mind, living more of that life in that bigger mind. And that's what this is all about. That's why this is so wonderful. Sesshin is the most wonderful thing, I believe. And Luzhu is doing just the right thing, right? He's facing the blankness. He's in just the right place. Whenever Luzhu saw a monk coming, see, he doesn't look to others, he doesn't look to externals for life energy. Because he's a free person. This is to live this life is to have a kind of extraordinary freedom, right? You might or you might not like me. You know, I might or I might not be successful. I might or I might not be healthy. You know, but to be a man of Zen or a woman of Zen is to live a different kind of. Those questions are not so important. Right? So Luzhu isn't he doesn't rush out and go, oh, I hope these people like me. I've got to welcome them to the temple. He looks into himself. He looks into the self is not the right word. He goes deeply into Mushin. We say turning inward, but that's also false. There's no inner and outer. That's an illusion. He goes deeply into Mushin. And that's his foundation. That's how he lives his life. He would immediately face the wall. Nansen says, oh, this, he could sit there forever and nothing's going to happen. He could sit there till the cows go home. But Nansen is paying him a deep compliment. He's saying, listen, there's nothing to be achieved. Humans say, there's something to be achieved. Humans say, there's a meaning. Humans say, etc. But in a bigger picture, the universe is unfolding not for some reason, not to fulfill some purpose, not to manifest some meaning. It's the Buddhist word for this, or the word we give in our tradition for this, is tathagata, pure thusness, pure presence. Things in their pure presence don't have a purpose or a meaning. They're bigger than purpose and meaning. See, they're bigger. It's a tathagata, pure presence. Pure presence. Nansen says he can sit there forever and nothing's going to be achieved, and he's absolutely right. The universe is going to unfold forever and nothing is going to be achieved. That's what makes it so beautiful. Right? In plainness, in emptiness, there's flavor, subtly transcending thought and expression. Continuously seeming to exist before any sign, before any thought. There's something there before any word, any idea, any meaning, any purpose. He's unbending like an idiot, you know? Sitting on the cushion like an idiot, not a thought in your head. His path is the loftiest. Jade, when you carve jade, it loses its purity, see? Before language, there's something bigger than the word can express. Before purpose, there's something bigger than purpose. When you carve the jade, its natural beauty is already lost. See, a pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. You don't need to set the pearl in any kind of a setting. A pearl sealed in an oyster at the bottom of the ocean is like perfection itself. Doesn't have to come out and be put on a ring to be beautiful, right? It's already perfect. See, the ring in a way kind of takes away from that perfection. See, that your bright mind is like a pearl in an oyster at the bottom of the ocean. So please swim down and enter that oyster at the bottom of the ocean, please. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar. This universe is at leisure. It's a play. This is not a purpose, right? The universe is really a free place, really free. It's not trying to achieve, it's just expressing itself in endlessly, infinitely. So this is our chance to be a part of that, see, be part of that unfolding. That's what Zen is all about. That's why it feels so good. It's like the energy of the universe in our bodies, in our bones. So welcome to Sesshin Day One. It's so wonderful to share this beautiful path with you. I'm so grateful to know each one of you and to practice with each one of you. It's infinitely precious, unspeakably precious. So let's do it. Let's walk this beautiful path together.